his groups, and we're also going to talk about the use of ultralight aircraft in emergency low-level aerial search and surveillance. After all of that, hi.
How you doing, Don?
Great. Be delighted to hear from you guys. You may be involved with this as well. By all means, give us a call if you'd like to find out more about the Powershoot or possibly how it can be used in surveillance. This would be a good time to do it. A number of law enforcement agencies have already signed on this.
Yeah, the idea was to be able to provide a set of eyes in the sky for fire departments, police departments, search and rescue teams. When they're searching for missing people, which is usually children, but not always, usually two kinds of aerial assistance are called in, either airplanes or helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
Although they're both effective, airplanes, of course, were never meant to look straight down unless they have a glass bottom when there aren't too many planes
not
built with
too many now.
Helicopters are the ultimate. I mean, nobody can question the fact that a helicopter can fly extremely slowly, low, and hover, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest drawback with helicopters is their cost. To run a helicopter, you're talking $150 to $300 an hour, plus the fact that helicopters are not always available when the local police departments need them. So my goal with the setting up of ELLAS, which ELLASS, which stands for Emergency Low-Level Aerial Search and Surveillance, was to use Powershoots, which is one form of ultralight aircraft, to assist these agencies in finding missing people. The Powershoot, which is the ultralight that I specialize in, flies at 30 miles an hour. That's the only speed it flies at. People ask me, Baron, how fast are you going? 30 miles an hour. How fast when you're climbing? 30 miles an hour. How fast when you're coming down? 30 miles an hour. How fast with the engine off? 30 miles an hour. Right. So no matter what happens, we are going at a relatively slow speed. Now, even a small airplane like a Cessna still is going more than twice that fast, and of course the pilot has to be banking the whole time to look down, whereas we can fly very low, very slow, and really get good coverage. And that's the whole idea, and I've been very, very happy. We just started this a couple months ago, and I approached a couple of the local police departments, and already the Cornwall Borough Police Department, the South Anvil Police Department, and the Mount Gretna Fire Department have all indicated that they're extremely interested in using our services when they are looking for lost people.
And, of course, those are areas that are wooded. Those are areas that have hiking trails. Those are the kinds of places where people, indeed, could go missing, whether they're out hiking recreationally, or it could be hunters who manage to get turned around one too many times.
Exactly, exactly. The thing is that, you know, there's no replacing a man on the ground. I mean, you know, eyes and ears on the ground are, you have to be there. But what I'm trying to do is save the police and the search and rescue teams and the fire departments time by covering a larger area faster. And because, you see, what people think is that I'm just up there in this, or whoever's flying the Powershoot is just up there in this little flimsy thing. We have all of the same things that any plane or helicopter has. We have full radio-to-ground communications and ground air-to-air, you know, full avionics. I have a GPS so that if I spot something, I can, you know, punch the button and give the people on the ground the exact locations within 3 feet of what it is I see. You know, the whole nine yards. I'm having a phone installed in a couple weeks on the Powershoot that I use, so that I'll actually be able to, you know, let's say that there's a little girl named Melissa missing, for instance.
Okay.
I'll be able to fly over a specific area, and I'll be able to have the person in the back seat announcing, you know, Melissa, if you can hear this, please go to, or please go to the opening over here, please go to the opening over there.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a bit more of a problem when there are leaves on the trees in the densely forested areas, because, of course, we can only see down to the open areas like the fields and the roads. But then again, we are hoping in the not-too-distant future to obtain and mount on the frames the thermal imaging devices. Now, once we have that, and we look at a little screen that would be mounted, you know, on the seat, we could actually see people, you know, under vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to think about it, but we can even see bodies that are buried in shallow graves, even after a couple days. Believe it or not, they still give off enough heat to show up on these very sensitive thermal imagers.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that we can do to, you know, mm-hmm. to support the police.
Guys, if you got some questions about this, if you'd like to find out more, give us a call, 273-1270, 1-800. 800-334-1270, toll-free. Baron Taylor aboard, talking about ELIS, which is Emergency Low-Level Aerial Search and Surveillance, and talking a little bit about Powershoot as well, which is a kind of ultralight. If you're into the ultralights, want to find out a little more about them, or how this all gets used in search and rescue, by all means, give us a call. Let's talk a little bit about Powershoots. This is the kind of thing, you look at it, and it almost looks improbable. How does it do that?
The whole activity of power shooting started about 20 years ago, and I tell you, you couldn't pay me enough to get into those original ones. They were really death traps just waiting to happen. But amazingly enough, the very few people really got seriously hurt back then because, once again, we're moving so slowly, and of course, as you said, it looks so improbable, you always have a parachute over your head. I mean, that's the whole thing.
That's a plus.
The whole time you're up in the air, from takeoff to landing, you always have a parachute over your head. So even if the engine goes off or whatever, all you do is float down to the earth. The activity of parachuting really came into its own probably, I'd say, about five to eight years ago, when the technology all came together. The companies that were making you've seen these parachutists that come down at the stadiums and
sure.
stuff,
mm-hmm.
and you know they land. You can see them. They land within 2 feet, 3 feet, because they're controlling. You know, they're pulling on
mm-hmm.
these levers back
mm-hmm.
and they're specially made parachutes. Well, the companies that were manufacturing those parachutes for the parachutists, you know, woke up. They said, "Hey, we've got this sport here." Of people that really need quality parachutes for these
mm-hmm.
little machines that they're flying, let's make them for them. So now we have companies that make these very specific, specially designed parachutes, which act as our airfoils. They're extremely safe, very reliable. They inflate well, and you know they virtually never stall. And then, of course, the little trike itself, or the little craft that we fly in is now made of you know aircraft grade aluminum with aircraft grade bolts and nuts, and you know everything is brought up to snuff. And at the present time, they're extraordinarily safe because all of the same redundancy systems that are used in any plane is you know used in these.
Tell you what, we're going to head to the lines here. Hello, you're on Radio Talk, WLBR.
Yeah, Don.
Howdy.
This is Snake.
Hello.
Yeah, this has a lot to do personally with me. When my daughter was like six back in 1990-91, she got lost in the woods. Near our house that we were living
mm-hmm.
in, and it was wooded, okay? And it was a township that had no police coverage, okay? So it worked through the state police. Does this gentleman work with the state police?
We will work with any agency that calls us. It makes absolutely no difference whether it's a local or a state or, for instance, after the shuttle crash in Texas, not too many people know it, but approximately 20 power parachutists went down to Texas and spent 2 weeks helping NASA and the other agencies locate shuttle parts because, once again, they could cover a lot more area much faster from the air than the people could on the ground. And they did help locate a lot of parts, but it's not very well known. It just wasn't publicized very much. So the answer is yes. I mean, for instance, right now, we've just started off telling people about us, and already we've been contacted by Child Quest International and the nation's Missing Children Organization, both of which are national organizations which help agencies locate missing children.
So it's just more than just local borough police or whatever.
Exactly. Well, look, we have just started, literally, in the past couple months putting this together. I have, you know, obviously a short-term and a long-term goal. My short-term goal is that within the next 2 years, I would like to have an ELIS chapter set up, one in Texas, one in California, and one somewhere in the Midwest, such as Illinois or Wisconsin. That way, let's say somebody calls us from Colorado and needs us there, you know, we can be there within a 12 to 14-hour drive time. My long-term goal is to have a chapter in every single state, at least one in every state, so that when we get the call, we can be on scene within, you know, 2 or 3 hours. So you
drive there in like a van or something and set up and launch.
Exactly. And because parachutes don't need much in the way of facilities, we can use a football field. I mean, literally, the local high school football field can be used as our base of operations for takeoff and landing. I mean, that's how short a space we need.
Oh, okay. Do you get funding, like, through the Civil Air Patrol? Or?
Right now, all of our funding is private. I mean, we are the Parachute Education Foundation, which is the parent organization, which is running ELIS, is a 501c3 IRS-approved tax-exempt organization. So, you know, we are looking for corporate sponsors, and, of course, we accept all private donations as well. All donations are fully tax-deductible.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you.
There you go.
Okay.
Hey,
bye.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
That is actually kind of a natural lead into how folks could get involved here. We'll be right to the lines. Hang on there, guys. We know you're coming here.
There really are you know, two levels of involvement. One, of course, not everybody wants to fly. Mm-hmm. It would be great if we had more pilots, and that way, more people flying, more coverage, we can help find people faster, and I am at the moment training a couple more pilots right now. But the other thing, of course, is that unfortunately, you don't like to talk about it, but the reality is all organizations run on money.
Sure.
And we, like any other organization, need money. You know, as I said, from a private standpoint, the individual, we are willing to accept any donation, whether it's $10 or $100 or $5. You know, we're grateful for anything. On the corporate level, we would really like to see some of the local companies come up and get involved. For instance, I mean, just to throw an idea out, there are a lot of businesses, particularly, for instance, restaurant chains such as Golden Corral or Friendly's or others. Now, they serve thousands of people a week. And if one of these corporations would just say, look, we'll give you 2 or 3 cents per person that we serve every week. That's all. I mean, they wouldn't even, mm-hmm. you know, just a small amount. And then, you know, send you a check every month for that. Well, that would help us tremendously. Or if someone like Hess, one of our, you know, better-known local gas companies, mm-hmm. would say, listen, we'll donate the gas that you need to run these things. And we're not talking a lot of money. We're talking $200 a month, mm-hmm. maybe. But, you know, it's every little bit helps in the operation.
Mm-hmm. What's the best way folks can get in touch with you?
Well, we have one website up right now, www.ellass, which is ELLASS.org. We're working currently on the Parachute Education Foundation website, and we do accept, by the way, I don't want to make this sound too commercial, but we do accept credit cards. Unfortunately, we have not got the links yet on the ELIS site for the donation. So if people do want to donate, or any corporations or anyone out there wants to contact me, please go to the ELIS website, and it has our email address as well as our telephone number and everything else, and I'll be glad to talk to you.
No, hey, you're trying to, you should pardon the expression, get this off the ground. So there's nothing wrong with letting folks know how they can help out. Those aboard, give me just a chance here to keep our lights burning. We'll be talking with Baron Taylor of ELIS, which is the acronym for Emergency Low-Level Aerial Search and Surveillance. Also, Parachute Education Foundation, which is kind of the umbrella or parachute organization over ELIS. You knew it was coming.
I did, yeah.
Give us a call, 273-1270. Perhaps a thought or two on ultralights, how ELIS works as far as search and surveillance goes. Give us a ring, 273-1270, 1-800-334-1270. Toll free for our surrounding counties. How'd you get into all of this?
Well, I've wanted to fly my whole life, really. But it was one of those things, everybody says, I want to do something, but, you know, I'll do it next year when I get time.
Uh-huh.
You know how you go through that, and years go by, and years go by, and years go by. Well, 4 years ago, through the one of the miracles of modern medicine, my life was saved literally on the operating table. I had an aortic aneurysm. And, you know, when you wake up in the intensive care, you know, recovery room with all these tubes coming out of you all over the place, and the thought really hits you, you know, there almost wasn't a tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, it was not just a figure of speech anymore, but there literally almost wasn't a tomorrow. And you start reassessing your life, you know, and a lot of the things that you thought were so important aren't so important anymore. And a lot of the little things, they kept pushing back and pushing back. And you know, you say to yourself, maybe it's about time that I really started to give serious consideration to doing these things. You know, and there were a lot of things I wanted to do, such as spending more time with my family. I have four wonderful kids and a lovely wife. And one of the things that was going through my mind was, you know, Baron, you've always wanted to fly. And my wife will attest to the fact that one of the things I told her very soon after my heart operation was, I said, you know, I've always wanted to fly. Now I'm going to do something about it. And I looked around and settled on flying powered parachutes because, A, they're relatively inexpensive to get into. They're easy to fly, easy to learn. Not that I'm uncoordinated, but you know, I didn't want to spend years learning how to fly something. And the other thing was that I got online and I did some research, and what amazed me was how many pilots of commercial jets, I'm talking about, you know, the big, the heavies, the 730, the 747, fly powered parachutes. And, you know, you think that these guys that sit in these cockpits where there's, you know, wall-to-wall lights and dials and switches and buttons, you know, why would they want to go up in a craft that basically has four controls? You push left on the left steering tube to go left if you want with your foot. You push right on the right steering tube with your foot to go right. Mm-hmm. To go up, you push the throttle forward to increase your RPM. And to go down, you pull it back. That's it. That's all there is to flying a powered parachute.
Whoa.
Well, of course, taking off and landing are a bit more complicated, but not much. And the reason why these guys fly it is because they consider this really flying. You know, when they're in their cockpits on a commercial jet, they like to refer them to themselves as spam in a can. I mean, they're a mechanical pilot. They sit there, they work the plane, but they only go where they're told to go. You know, they're vectored in by air traffic control. They fly at this speed, at this altitude, on this course, and that's it. That's all they do. It's, you know, they enjoy what they do, or else they wouldn't be doing it, but it's still a job, and they can't go where they want to go. Or you get up on a powered parachute, and you go wherever you want to go within reason, and you enjoy yourself.
Which is one thing we probably do want to talk about, since we are talking about an air search kind of thing. Restricted airspaces, places that these babies can't go.
Right. Okay. By FAA regulations that cover ultralights, all ultralights, we are not allowed to fly over what they call congested areas of cities, towns, stuff like that. Now, when I think of congested, I think of runny nose and watery eyes. But that's not, and no one really knows what the FAA means by congested.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for those of us who think about it, basically what we do is we try to avoid flying over, you know, heavily, densely populated areas. Now, you know, people have probably seen me flying all over the county because I'm up so much and I fly for hours at a time. And I do fly over perhaps like the outskirts of Lebanon, maybe, you know, one of the developments right over there. But I would never, unless it was some sort of terrible emergency or I had absolutely no other choice, I would never fly over downtown Lebanon. By the same token, we're not allowed to fly over, you know, over 10,000 people, you know, where people get together like a major stadium or something like that. We're supposed to avoid those. And there are other restricted airspaces such as Harrisburg, which has Class D airspace. There are regulations for that as well.
I would imagine Fort Indian Town Gap would be another.
Muir Airport there, once again, is Class D, but they also have military training there, and you don't want to go into them. You don't want to go near there. The other thing about powered parachutes also is that in terms of ultralights, they are by most people in the industry considered the safest ultralight because they do have a flexible airfoil overhead. Now, if something should happen with one of the Delta type where the Delta is damaged or something like that happens, or it goes into a stall and it's not in the correct position, it's much harder for it to right itself and get itself back into position, whereas with the powered parachute, it's virtually unheard of for them not to reinflate almost instantaneously back into their original position again.
You have lots of individual air cells there, too.
Exactly. Parachutes that we use are called ram parachutes. If you actually look at them, it's really two layers. The front of the parachute is open, so and it's broken into cells. If you look at it, it looks like cells all across the front. So when we're flying, the air is being forced into the front of the parachute. which creates a very rigid, it's flexible, but fairly rigid airfoil. And that's what inflates it all. And as we're moving forward, it creates this wing shape, the exact same thing as the wing of an airplane. And it's all very carefully designed. I mean, it's
the lift is amazing that can be generated by this.
It's incredible, the amount of lift. And the steering ability is great. I mean, we have the steering lines. And, for instance, as I said, when I push out on the left steering tube, what happens is that tube pulls on a rope, and that rope goes up through a pulley system and pulls on some strings that are attached to the back trailing edge of the left side of the chute.
We'll get into the technology on the other side on our Tuesday edition, talking with Baron Taylor. Baron Taylor of ELAS, which is the acronym for Emergency Low-Level Aerial Search and Surveillance. Also, Parachute Education Foundation, which is a... You can do the alphabet soup and the numbers on this. It's a tax-free charitable contribution kind of thing, which indeed is there to help educate folks about the parachutes and also to help organize the search and surveillance teams. We'd like to hear from you. Got some thoughts on ultralight aircraft? I know a number of folks are interested in those, or possibly a little bit more about how ELAS works. 273-1270, 1-800-334-1270, toll-free. 4 hours, surrounding counties. Light them up. Like to hear from you. You've mentioned that the parachute requires a very short takeoff and landing area. Where do you do this?
There are a lot of grass airstrips. We prefer grass over paved simply because there's less wear and tear on our chutes. Mm-hmm. You know, although the chute pops up right off the ground almost immediately as soon as we start our takeoff roll, even that, you know, that 2, 3, 4 feet. Before it pops up, you do that enough times, and you know the chute material is quite thin, and you're going to start wearing out your chute and your lines very quickly. Mm-hmm. As long as we continue to take off and land on grass, the chutes will last almost forever. And what surprised me, what pleasantly surprised me, was how many grass airstrips there are in Lebanon and surrounding counties. And not only that, but there are a lot of, most of the strips even that are paved have a wide grass strip next to them so that the airstrip owners allow us to take off and land. Usually we're in the air within 50 to 75 yards. I mean, if we're not in the air after 100 yards, something is probably seriously wrong, and we better abort that takeoff and find out what's going on. I was flying yesterday, for instance. Now, mind you, I do not recommend this for people who are not, you know, really experienced and know what they're doing, but I was flying yesterday, probably taking off in winds of 12 to 14 miles an hour. Most power parachutists don't take off in winds of more than 5 or 6. But the nice part is when you're taking off into a headwind of, 12, 14 miles an hour, as soon as I powered up, bang, I mean, that chute popped and we were off the ground in about 10 yards. I mean,
I would believe that. As I say, just sort of extrapolating from the parakite, which I've got, the lift that is generated by the individual cells is just staggering.
Oh, it is. I mean,
you can, you know, really feel an incredible pull.
Yeah.
Other kites will be up there sort of dancing around in a light wind, and this, right up.
That's correct. That's correct. Now, the only thing the only drawback to a landing strip, if there is a drawback, is that strips either go usually in one direction. Well, I say two directions. You can approach from either end, but almost all the landing strips in Lebanon County are laid out east-west. Now, there are a couple exceptions. For instance, Deck is north-south. Now, Deck is paved and does not at the moment have much in the way of grass for me to land and take off on, but I have spoken with the owners of Deck, and hopefully next year they're going to expand the grass area next to the paved area, so we'll be able to take off there. But see, that's the biggest problem with ultralights as a whole, is the wind direction. We have to take off and land into the wind. Well, actually, all planes are supposed to. I mean, even the commercial jets, you know, they try to line them up with the wind. But because we're so light and because that chute catches the wind so quickly, or the delta wing or whatever kind it is, we really try to get as close to facing into the wind as possible when taking off and landing. So that when I'm taking off and landing, for instance, yesterday, I was working with a crosswind. The wind was coming out of the north Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once again, I would not recommend this for someone fresh out of school who hasn't flown very much, but with enough hours, you know, you can learn how to crab, know how to take off and land and do it correctly. It was an interesting day flying yesterday, flying with the crosswinds, especially that strong. You know, I have a wish list of things for the foundation, and one of the things on the wish list would be that if a farmer or a landowner somewhere in Lebanon County has a piece of land that's relatively flat of approximately 200 yards in diameter, we're not talking a lot, just 200 yards in diameter, that they wouldn't mind putting into grass. And I tell you something, the foundation would even be willing to foot the bill for putting it into grass. I mean, that's how much we'd like to have it.
Mm-hmm.
A round circle like that would allow us basically to take off and land in any direction.
Any kind of day.
And most people don't know this, by the way. This is not an original idea. Back in the early days of aviation, if you go to any of the original, you know, little airports, they didn't have landing strips. They were just great big huge open fields.
Mm-hmm.
And that way the planes, and they were biplanes basically back then, take off. They would just taxi to whichever end of the field, you know, was facing into the wind and take off. And when they were landing, they would just look at the windsock and land that way. It wasn't until, you know, later on when, you know, strips became more formalized in an east, west, north, south, or whatever direction they were in.
Mm-hmm. What sort of range does your parachute have?
Well, we're flying at 30 miles an hour once we take off. With two people, you know, we're chewing up between 3.5 and 4 gallons an hour. So that basically tells you, you know, we can fly for about 2.5 hours. And that'll be on the safe side. I like to land at about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't want to come in on fumes. So you're looking at covering about 60 miles, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Okay, which can indeed cover a lot of ground if you're doing a search and rescue kind.
Absolutely.
Of thing. Yeah. During the break, we got talking a little bit about the safety factor on the parachute, and since we just did hear a little bit about parachutes, this is probably an apt time to talk about that.
Yeah, I want to let your listeners know that now I'm speaking about powered parachutes in particular.
Mm-hmm.
They have been very justly described as the safest way form of flight ever invented. You know, not just using the cliche that there's always a parachute over your head. But the powered parachutes have all of the same safety and redundancy factors that any regular airplane has. We have dual ignition systems, two magnetos, so in case one goes off, you still have the other one. We have dual carburetors. All the safety factors, I want everyone to understand, if the worst case, let's just take the worst case.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that I passed out. I mean, I blacked out. There was no control at all, and we come down and we just hit, okay? I mean, we just glide down in an uncontrolled descent and we hit. The impact is the equivalent to taking the powered parachute, jacking it up 4 feet off the ground, and dropping it. That's it. That's the same impact. So, you know, okay, you're talking about being a little shaken up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're going to bend a tube or two, but you're going to walk away. And, you know, because you're strapped in with a four-point harness just like they use in airplanes. I mean, nothing is different. It's all the same. But we're moving much slower, which is one of the reasons why a death in powered parachuting is almost unheard of. I mean, it does happen. A few people every year get killed.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to happen. I mean, look at motorcycles. We had this other gentleman this last call talking about, he likes to motorcycle. Mm-hmm. Well, motorcycling is a fabulous sport. But look at how many thousands of people a year die motorcycling. So, you know, it's all relative.
Yep. Hello, you're on Radio Talk, WLBR.
I realized there's a call back, and I apologize.
Oh, okay. Well, take 30.
Yeah, I haven't heard anybody ask this, and I thought somebody would, and I'll hang up. What is the cost involved in getting started, and how old is too old when they would say to you, you're too old to do this? So I'll just...
Okay.
And I'll listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Right.
Well, to teach someone to go from zero to solo generally costs $500. And in other words, all the instructors I know, myself included, that's just a blanket cost. If it takes you five lessons to go through solo, That's $500. If it happens to take you 15 lessons to go through solo, it's still $500. It's just a flat fee. Once you've gone through solo, then you have to rack up a couple more solo hours to get your pilot certificate, at which point you can safely fly a single-seater. Now, if you're going to go for your instructor's certificate, which does take some FAA, you have to pass one or two tests, and one of them is mandated by the FAA, then you have to get another 20-some hours of solo flight and about 10 hours of additional instruction to become an instructor. The cost of those hours of solo flight is really dependent upon whether you have bought your own machine to use or whether you're renting your instructor's machine and stuff like that. To be honest, I wanted to get my helicopter's license, but to get a helicopter pilot certificate cost a minimum of $10,000 to $12,000.
Whoa.
Yeah, and most of that is not the time involved. You're talking about, once again, the cost of operating the helicopter. The nice part about operating a powered parachute is that your hard costs, including your engine tear down and rebuild, if you factor all that in, it's just a little under $20 an hour. It's very inexpensive. And as long as you take good care of your machine, it will last virtually forever. I know someone's probably thinking, well, but how much do these machines cost? A single-seater, a good single-seater, can be picked up, used with very low hours, for in the neighborhood of between $5,000 and $8,000, which is, you know, relatively inexpensive. Mm-hmm.
So the initial costs, while not inconsiderable, aren't enormous, and after that, you're sort of set.
That's correct.
Guys, we do want to remind you that if you're interested in finding out more about parachute flying, or if you're already into this kind of thing and you'd like to get involved with the ELAS part of it, which is Emergency Low-Level Aerial Search and Surveillance. We want to hit the website one more time before we wrap
it's
here.
It's www.ellass.org. There is the information to contact me there. And I don't mind giving out my telephone number. If people want to call me directly, they can. It's a local Lebanon number here. It's 279-6666. And they're welcome to call me direct. If I don't happen to answer, just please leave a message, and believe me, I'll get right on back to you.
And again, you know, if there are police and emergency services organizations who'd like to find out about this, if there are folks who might have that 200-foot diameter circle that they could donate in a field, if there are perhaps organizations who'd like to set up some sort of a donation, you know, same situation.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've been invited to speak to a Lions Club in about 2 weeks. They're interested in what we're doing, and they want to see how they can get involved. So any of the local community service organizations, I do encourage the local police and fire departments to contact me. If, you know, if they think they can use our services, I'd like to come out, speak with them, show them what we can do. You know, and get them involved.
That's a great addition to the Valley. Baron, thanks for being aboard. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye.